Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 425th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormick, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the UBC, at the University of British Columbia. You can tell it's, you know, we've been off on summer stuff. Words don't work anymore. It's always difficult, but school's starting up soon.
Hopefully you can go. I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor, as well as the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. And speaking of that college, we have in the studio with us Sam, who is a member of PEER and works for the College of Family Physicians of Canada. Sam.
Hi, everybody. I'm a clinical pharmacist by training. I worked in family medicine for 10 years, and now I'm helping to develop tools at the College of Family Physicians.
And she did such a great job last time that we've asked her to come back again to talk about stuff to do with opioid use disorder. And it's a really good question, I think, Mike. I think you'd agree.
Right. And this is a key one, and it does seem to generate a lot of frustration and uncertainty. And there's, of course, with the opioid crisis as it is, there's lots of questions about how much the prescription of pharmaceuticals played in that. There's lots of debate about it. And as you know, just today, there was a case in the United States that went against the drug company. Mm-hmm. So there's debate. How much do prescription drugs play a role in the dependence and opioid use disorder? And what are the chances with an individual prescription? Those kind of things. And it's actually surprisingly hard to find answers. There are answers, and they range from your risk being virtually zero to probably somewhere around 50% in some of this research. So it's crazy variation in numbers. And even if you try and narrow it down, it gets tricky. And in our simplified opioid use disorder treatment guideline, one of the biggest issues we had with peer review was when we tried to provide a number for that, even if it was a range of, let's say, 2 to 10% or 3 to 5%, people got angry at that. And we had to, we really received a lot of feedback around those numbers. So that pushed Sam and I to do a more thorough look at the evidence. And Sam's the one that really jumped in with both feet. So I'll let her lead us through the evidence, and then we'll kind of give you a bottom line and hopefully fill in some of the gray fuzzy bits around the outside of whatever we say.
So the clinical question that we were trying to ask or figure out is, what is the risk of developing opioid use disorder when taking prescription opioids? And the studies we came across were trying to describe the incidence of opioid use disorder. So that would be new cases of OUD developing after opioid prescriptions are given. And we felt that incidence would be a better estimate of iatrogenic OUD than prevalence. So remembering that prevalence describes existing cases, and it really could include cases of OUD that could occur before any prescription opioid is given. So the studies we looked at focused on incidence.
Yeah, so I think that Sam, sorry to interrupt, but it's a linchpin to understanding why would we choose incidence over prevalence. And so I could be someone who has accessed opioids either from a prescription from someone else that I got from them, or I bought from them, or I stole from them, or I could have picked it up on the street somehow. And I could be dependent on opioids. And then as a fallback position, I've gone to a prescriber and asked for a prescription of opioids to augment my street use or the drugs that I've taken in some other way. So in those cases, the cause, if you like, of my opioid use disorder didn't initiate from a prescription opioid. And that's the piece that we were trying to tease out. What are the chances of developing it because of the prescriptions that were received? And I know that people are saying right now, it's not just because of the prescription received. It's all of the things that go into the encounter. It's the patients, what they brought with it. Do they have a genetic susceptibility? Do they have adverse child events that can, we know seem to contribute, all of these kind of things. We recognize that. But what seemed to start with prescriptions, I think, is the big issue.
And to do that, it's
incidence.
Sorry, it's interesting because, Mike, I'm sure you remember many, many years ago, there was a letter to the editor about what is the incidence of people getting addicted to prescriptions. And it was literally a three-sentence letter. And I think it said, you know, that out of, and it's in the tens of thousands of people who got opioids in a hospital, only 7, you know, ended up getting addicted to it. And that letter from years and years ago is what I was taught and what many, many people were taught, in that it doesn't, you know, it's almost, it never happens. And that's, you know, almost been the mantra for years and years and years. And we now know that is not true. But it was really interesting how a letter without any, without them showing how they got the information or whatever, became sort of the de facto process. And that's why it's really important, I think, that we go through the best available evidence to help us with that.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot. And then take that limited information that you provided and then add in all of our own personal biases.
Exactly.
Right.
And yeah,
it's a very challenging thing, and some people are very passionate about these answers. But anyway, Sam, take us back to the evidence piece.
So the first study to talk about was published in 2018, and it was a systematic review that included studies about the incidence of OUD and excluded studies around the prevalence of OUD. And it included 12 studies of 310,000 patients. And these were patients who were prescribed opioid therapy for at least 7 days. And in fact, 97% of them had been on treatment for at least 3 months. The outcomes that they used in this trial were a clinical diagnosis of opioid dependence or abuse disorder. And these were established by using the DSM criteria or the ICD criteria or a physician's assessment. So just keep in mind that these studies were published, the range was from 1995 to 2015, and the DSM-5 criteria were published in 2013. So they're using outcomes that we may, are descriptions of outcomes that we may not be using today. So these were patients, again, with pain who received opioid analgesic therapy. And there were a mix of studies, so prospective cohort studies, cross-sectional studies, pre-post studies. And the majority of them were for patients who had non-malignant pain. And so what the systematic review showed was that the incidence was 4.7% of patients prescribed opioid therapy had a new diagnosis of opioid dependence or abuse during that follow-up period. When you restrict to the higher quality studies, the incidence was about 3%. So that gives us an idea of roughly what the number might be, so around 3%. And it's interesting because depending on the diagnostic criteria used, that incidence varied. So if studies used a DSM-4 criteria, their pooled incidence was higher than if studies used the ICD criteria. So there was some variability around that as well. So that's what I'm going to say for the first study.
I think this is already hitting on a couple of the key things that are going to provide limitations to this data. Now, this doesn't mean that what we're going to give you as a summary in the end means that it's all, we can dismiss it all and it's back to guesswork. I still think this is going to be the best estimate we can get. But remember now that we're using older definitions and would have included words like addictions and that kind of thing. We're using different definitions to define opioid use disorder. So we're using DSM, we're using sometimes a physician's diagnosis, sometimes other diagnostic criteria like the ICD-9. So there's a lot of variability embedded within here. The duration that people are on these drugs, the duration of follow-up that they got, the types of studies, as you mentioned, that seem to impact. I know that I would have focused more on cohort studies, and they did. Those were the higher level studies, and they did find slightly less. So there's lots of really important caveats here. That so if you're not happy with these numbers, I can understand why, but there's really not a lot better, unfortunately. Anyway, Sam, take us through the next one.
Mm-hmm. So the next systematic review was published 10 years prior, so in 2008, and it included 24 studies of 2,507 patients, and these patients were chronic pain patients prescribed opioid therapy, and they had to have therapy for at least a month, but in fact, the average exposure to their opioid therapy was 26 months, and the range was anywhere from 2 months to 240 months. The incidence of opioid addiction that they found was 3.3%, so very similar to the higher quality studies in the previous systematic review. And the other interesting thing that this systematic review did was they wanted to look at what the incidence of OUD was in patients without a history of substance abuse or addiction, and compare it to those who did have a positive history of substance abuse and addiction. And in fact, for those without a history of abuse or addiction, the incidence was 0.2% versus 5% among those with a positive history. So I think it speaks to, and this is consistent with some of the guideline recommendations in the McMaster guidelines, that suggest that patients who have a positive history are at greater risk for OUD, and those guidelines go on to recommend us being more prudent and cautious about prescribing opioids in that population. But I think it also speaks to perhaps that it's quite rare, in fact, to develop OUD if you don't have a history of substance abuse or addiction.
And I think this actually speaks even more to the variability that we see in the study. So if I'm looking at a practice that if I drew my data from a chronic pain practice where opioids were regularly used, we might have more patients in there with a history of opioid use disorder or any substance use disorder. And so my numbers for OUD may be higher than someone who took this straight from primary care practice or another type of practice that would have less patients with substance use. Maybe one of the studies we looked at was very careful about weeding out people who may have had a substance use disorder, and their numbers for the incidence was much lower. And mm-hmm. so obviously doesn't surprise us, but we're gonna mention those in just a minute.
So in that case, I think it's going to be very different than a person who's being given opioids for chronic pain and the chance of becoming dependent on it and so on. So there's so many variables here, and ultimately we're trying to just give or have people appreciate, is there a chance of them getting some sort of dependence? And the answer is for sure yes, and a ballpark idea of the magnitude, because whether it's 3% or 4% or 5% is irrelevant. If it's zero, yeah, that's really important to know. And if it's 80 or 90%, and we just need to know ballpark numbers, and that's all we're going to be able to give anyway because of all of the variability in the studies that you guys have already talked about.
And I think people here who are going to look for precision in these numbers, you can pick individual studies that support your belief. You can always find that. But are you actually looking at the broad context? I, for example, when I started to do this, I thought these numbers would be higher than 3% or so, and the 0.2 in people without a substance use. I still thought it would be higher. Yeah. But I would say pleasantly surprised. It's certainly not zero, like you indicated, but yeah. I was thinking it was worse.
And why do you think you would have thought that? Is that just based on like every experience, all the experiences that you've had?
Yeah, I think also as a doctor and the kind of do no harm, I approach a lot of these things with fear. I used to tell everyone that the chances of a joint injection leading to an infection was somewhere between 100 and 1,000. Mm-hmm. And really, I was totally wrong. It's like 1 in 16,000 or something right. like that. But I think because I worry about causing harm, mm-hmm. And then when you see anything befalling patients, you worry about the harm that we do. So I think that's probably some of the grounding for it. And if you see it once, it happens a lot in your mind.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
I think these are, go ahead, James.
No, and it's great that you bring up because, and it's why it's so important that when you have a belief, like Mike, I mean, you're as evidence-based as people can be, you know, for most things, but we still have beliefs and fears and all that, that jade us in a direction. And so that's why it's so important to have these little synopses of evidence so that it can at least frame it a little bit better than like what you're saying, when you're off by orders of a magnitude of 10 sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And that's just it. And you know, we're scratching the surface of the evidence. It's the best evidence we have. But it's interesting to me, like my original question when I went into this was going to be, what are the chances of getting substance use disorder from a single prescription of Tylenol 3s? You know, like we used to give acetaminophen with codeine for an acute injury if you couldn't use an NSAID, and that or it wasn't responding to NSAIDs, and those would be 20 to 30 pills, you know, prescribed. And now I wonder, you know, I don't think we'll ever get that data.
Yeah.
But I thought that would be out there, but yeah. It's of course not.
And you forgot
people who are using a lot longer.
And I was going to say, and you forgot to mention the 292s. You don't remember those?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And yeah. Tylenol ones that people get over the counter themselves and all sorts of things.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
This is, you know, I think the data is pretty solid for what.
Yeah.
I think this is as close as it's going to get. But yeah, we still have a lot of limits to this information. Anyway, Sam, go ahead, finish off the.
Yeah, so just the last two systematic reviews, which I'll only really mention in brief, did report an incidence among lower risk patients, and that incidence was 0.3 to 0.5%. But again, like the number of studies including patients with a history of substance abuse was very low in these particular systematic reviews.
These are the ones that I was talking about where they pretty carefully weeded them out.
Yep.
So that the numbers wouldn't seem quite as, or so that the numbers would be better, because lower is better here.
Yep. So, I mean, for those of you who are interested in prevalence numbers, we did take a look at those to see what that range was. And there's a huge variation in terms of what's out there, what kind of outcomes were used. But that prevalence of OUD ranges anywhere from 0.05% to up to 23%. And there's a wide, you know, a variety of populations being studied, lots of different terminologies. So that's part of the reason why there's so much range in that number.
Mm-hmm. But that, just to clarify that range, that's a range of 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 4.
Yeah.
So those are subtle differences, James.
Really?
Your chances 1 in 4 or 1 in 2,000.
Sound the same. They sound the same to me.
Yeah, so it's obviously, you know, this data is so susceptible to many of the variables, whether it's the diagnostic criteria, the population study, the length of reporting, all that stuff. So just keep that in mind. And that's why I think Sam's work and trying to boil us down to kind of that 3% number, which we'll talk about more, that's probably the closest to truth that we have at this present time.
Mm-hmm, for sure. The other things we looked at, I mean, we looked at a few other issues around dose and duration, and we looked at a little bit about what happens when we give adolescents and young adults prescription opioids. So maybe let's start with that one first. One of the studies we looked at was a longitudinal study, and it was kind of interesting because it was national data from the U.S., and they pulled, what they were doing is a study called Monitoring the Future. So they issued surveys to high school seniors, in fact, repeated those studies every 2 years until the participants turn 30, and then every 5 years thereafter. So they have a lot of longitudinal data. And this particular study talked about what happens if an adolescent is exposed to prescription opioids and wanted to see what happens when they were at age 35. So what they found was that if an adolescent was exposed to prescription opioids, they had a higher odds of using non-medical prescription opioids in the year, so at age 35, over the past year, compared to those who had not been exposed to any medical or recreational use at age 18. So there was a higher odds of using non-medical prescription opioids. To put that into context, if the adolescent had both used prescription opioids and non-medical prescription opioids, they had a higher odds, again, at 3.2. So there seems to be an association between exposure in adolescence and future non-medical prescription opioid use. There's a ton of limitations around this, of course. There's self-administered surveys. There's self-reporting bias. Students may not be going to school, and so you miss those kids who didn't attend class that particular day. Individuals who are drug users may be less likely to remain in longitudinal studies, so there's lots of limitations around that, but I think it kind of speaks to, maybe being a little bit more careful about prescribing them if you can find an alternative to a prescription opioid.
Mm-hmm. And that early exposure, right? We've talked about that with you've seen that in the literature around cannabis use, a worry that that early exposure could be more concerning. Mm-hmm. And certainly here, this lends to the idea that early exposure. Now, in some cases, pain is severe, et cetera, and it needs to be. But one of these studies was a dental study, and many patients probably respond quite well with NSAIDs. And unfortunately, we jump too quickly to the opioids with them, I think. So this is a good reminder for us, as you said, Sam, to be cautious about our use, particularly early on, because it may have consequences that we can't even begin to anticipate. These were good because they follow people so long. All of their biases are exactly right, so it might not be real, but it is a cautionary note. Mm-hmm. I think that's reasonable.
For sure. Around dose and duration, we pulled a cohort study that got its information from an insurance database. And so there was over 568,000 patients included in this cohort study over 12 months. And when they looked at duration, so whether or not duration has any bearing on the risk of OUD, the example I'll give here is, so for patients who are on a dose of anywhere from 36 to 120 milligrams per day of morphine equivalent. So for that range, which I think is fairly common for chronic pain, after acute use, the incidence was 0.12%, so acute use being 1 to 90 days of use, versus chronic use, the incidence was 1.3%, and chronic use being defined as prescription use for over 90 days. So again, there's a bit of a correlation here with longer duration prescriptions and the risk of developing opioid use disorder, which is perhaps something that we would probably be intuitive about.
Yeah, these are things that we would anticipate would be the case, but it's interesting, some of the other studies refute this, but there's reasons within the study that within those studies that cause limitations and make it susceptible to bias. For example, there's studies showing that your risk of getting opioid dependence is smaller on short-term prescriptions, short-acting opioids than long-acting opioids. But the reason for that is the patients who are selected to be on long-acting opioids are requiring opioids every single day, and therefore, so it's actually a false finding. This finding, I think, is relatively reliable, and we're going to be talking about. Sam's mentioning that they partitioned off the dose of 36 to 120 milligrams. The same findings were found when the doses were a little higher or a little lower, but we're just giving you an example of one of them. And it was quite clear because it jumped up, or it's relatively clear because it jumped up from a 0.12 to a 1.3. So that's 10 times. It's still not big numbers, but it's 10 times higher. And it does tell us there's probably a concern with the longer use.
Sure. In terms of doses, when they looked at, 1 to 36 milligrams morphine equivalent and compared it to patients on greater than 120 milligrams per day, the incidence for the lower doses of OUD was 0.7% versus 6.1% with the higher doses. So again, seeing a relationship between dose, so higher doses and a greater incidence of OUD. So for me, I think the takeaway point is, factors that are associated with an increased risk of OUD, duration, higher duration or longer duration, higher dose, and then certainly the history, like we talked about, of substance abuse disorder or substance use disorder.
Yeah, they're playing a very important role in impacting these numbers. Mm-hmm. So will we have an answer for, you know, that short term script of acetaminophen with codeine? Probably not ever. But do we have what I think is a reasonable answer right now? I would say yes, as best an answer as we can get at the present time. And as I said, some people are going to be dissatisfied that it's not higher or that it's not lower. But this is I would say the best estimate that we can come up with. And that is that the incidence of opioid use disorder associated with prescription opioids for chronic pain is likely around kind of a 3% level. And that's over 2 years of follow-up. On average, not consistently, but kind of on average. This doesn't mean that the opioid prescription caused the opioid use disorder, but it does, they are associated and relatively consistently associated. And there's all these other variables in there that meet criteria of biologic plausibility, like an increase in dose is more impactful, longer duration is more impactful, all of those things. So, James, you know the rules of causation as well as I do. There is some caution here in the rules of causation, meaning that they seem to imply that this may be a real effect, at least in part.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And I mean, you can never rule these things in completely in or completely out. But you know, there's enough there that you go, yeah, there's probably something there. And then I think one of the useful numbers is that, you know, in patients with no history of substance use, you know, the risk is less than that 3%. It's probably less than 1% and maybe even a half of a percent and so on. And those are just important numbers to remember. But, you know, a lot of people, like you said, I think will take offense one way or the other, which is kind of always weird. But let's go with the thing is, because some people will say, well, the numbers are pretty low, so that's not a big deal. But if you look at, for one out of every 33 people you prescribe an opioid to, they get an opioid use disorder. That is why we have such a problem with narcotics in this.
They get a rash that goes away. This is not an amoxicillin diarrhea case where it's better and, you know, after you stop the medicine. This is not that they all are. I know people are going to get hung up on that too. There are a few that turn into C. diff, but you know what I mean? This is a serious, serious condition.
Yeah.
That we played a part in.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be very cognizant of that and recognize the role we can play in something as serious as opioid use disorder. And as you said, if it is even close to 1 in 33, that's a concern.
When we say it's 3%, for the people who say that's not big enough, well, we're saying that, yes, it is a problem. And then people who say, it doesn't seem to be a problem, no, it is a problem. You know, but at least
if you had a drug that caused death in 1 in 100 people, everyone would say that's bad.
Yeah.
And if you've got an intervention that causes opioid use disorder for up to 1 in every 33, that's taking all comers, not people who are low risk or people who are higher risk, but just overall, that's still a concern, I think. And because the condition is so severe, it's not like a 3% increase in, like I said,
in diarrhea,
short-term rash diarrhea or, you know, something like that. This is a much more serious condition and lifelong.
Yeah. So does any of these numbers like change what you were already doing, Mike? I mean, when I look at them, it wouldn't change in any way, shape, or form when one would say this is when, you know, you should use a narcotic or not. I mean, you should still go through the thought process of, is there something other than an opioid that we could use? And if we are going to use an opioid, we probably should, you know, use it for as short a period of time as possible, have a good discussion about, you know, what to expect from the narcotic and the side effects associated with it, and maybe even talk about, you know, there is a potential for opioid use disorder if we're using it, and it's in the neighborhood of, say, 2 to 3%. I mean, those are the discussions that probably should go on. I doubt they go on a regular basis, but at least people now have some idea of the numbers. But does it fundamentally change anything that you would do, Mike?
It probably doesn't change a lot for me because I was nervous that these numbers may be higher.
Yeah.
And I but that doesn't mean that I'm more relaxed now. If you haven't, you know, you've been living under a rock if you haven't seen the consequences of opioid use disorder.
Right.
And so, so I think we have to, I still have this high level of caution, and it does give me a number to give to patients. Mm-hmm. And I like that more now, because I can say that the chances are, as you said, James, one in 33 of developing a lifetime substance use disorder. Like, that's concerning to me, even mm-hmm. that, but it's nice that I can now say a general number.
Now I just want to make sure that what you're saying, so it's not necessarily a lifetime disorder, would you say? Or are you saying
well,
that
it's
something that happens, so then you have to be conscious of it for the rest of their life? It's not, yeah. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So they can get treated and be mm-hmm. free of this, you know, the consequences of this, and lead an absolutely normal life and excel, etc. But that diagnosis for people is often hanging in the back of their mm-hmm. mind, and it's hanging in the mind of their clinicians.
Sure.
So, you know, if you've had a, let's say you have a history of alcohol use disorder, and I'm seeing you for pain, I'm reluctant to prescribe for you. So, in the opioid realm, for just the reasons we've talked about. And so these things, even though you're not suffering from, you know, what we would typically think of as alcoholism at the present mm-hmm. time, and you're not using, et cetera, it's still playing a part in the way you live your life.
Yeah.
And many of my patients who are free and clear for decades even will still say, I don't want you to prescribe me anything that's going to, you know, be a potential risk for substance use, whether that's a benzo or another opioid or what have you. So I think you have to think of these things as, you know, having, even if they're resolved for all intents and purposes, they still have impacts that kind of echo through their life.
Yeah. So just as we found out over years with everything else, if you've ever heard something is not addictive, it probably is. You know, you go back to barbiturates and benzodiazepines, and, you know, narcotics have been around for just as long as those guys have. But, you know, we literally went through probably 20 years of saying they are relatively not addictive, that you don't, you know, people don't get addicted to these things. And so
you can find early advertisements, James, of Valium saying that it's not, that it doesn't cause dependence.
Oh, yeah.
And the same, as you mentioned, with barbiturates, there's early advertisements of barbiturates that they're safe because they're not dependent for me.
So we've always known that opioids, get opioid use disorders, you get dependent on them, if you will. If any of us will get dependent on them if you take them long enough. But what we're talking about is a clinical issue associated with, you know, seeking and getting opioids and that sort of stuff. So now that this is great, I think the number is as good a ballpark number as we're probably ever going to have, because it's hard to do this research. But at least now, you know, clinicians can have an appreciation for where we're starting with, you know, what the numbers are. So anything else you guys want to add to this?
No, I think that just about covers it. Sam, anything from you?
Nope, I think that covers it well, too.
Now, I know, Mike, you desperately want to sell something, so why don't you go ahead?
I want to sell the PIPE conference, James, and it's coming up in October, and it's the 25th and 26th of October. That's a Friday, starts Friday afternoon and all day Saturday. James, you're always a regular participant, and I know you'll be there this year. And there's some workshops ahead on opioid use disorder and on evidence, whatever you'd like. Now, you can, as you know, you can do this by webcast, and we're gradually getting more and more webcasters. It's working quite well. And we also have a lot of seats for people who want to come and be with us at the conference. There's a kind of evening reception on the Friday evening.
Yeah. It's always fun.
Where drinks are offered, and you can even chat with celebrities like James McCormick.
Yeah, that's why there's alcohol, so that it makes me much more tolerable.
And people can tolerate you.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
So the conference is coming up. Mike's done an excellent job, as usual, stewarding us through the process of getting this all certified, and great speakers again this year. So
that's Mike Colbert. You're not talking in, you know,
I'm talking about myself. Yeah. Hardly. Yeah. No, it's the Practical Evidence for Informed Practice Conference, the PIPE conference. And you can get it at the ACFP site. And like I said, we have people from all over North America who do sign on. So please check it out.
Yeah. And, no, excellent.
Hopefully we'll see you there.
So continue to check out all the stuff that we do on the peer site and the therapeutics education site and all that sort of stuff. All of the tools for practice that we create, which is one of the ones that we've just gone over. There's new ones coming out every couple of weeks, and boy, they are sure useful when it comes to figuring out what the heck you're supposed to do in practice. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Bye.